Today on Movie Wallace, we bring you our first day of coverage from the Tribeca Film Festival 2019. It's time for Movie Wallace. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallace is your weekly list of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. And greetings to all the listeners from Tribeca Film Festival 2019.
Yes, coming to you live from New York City.
Yes.
And we are kind of speaking in sort of hushed voices here. It'll sound fine to the listeners, but just so that you might... if you notice that we're not our usual energetic, loud, bantery selves.
It's late.
And we're in an Airbnb somewhere in the middle of New York, and we're very conscious of our neighbours. So,
damn neighbours.
Right. So, here we are again to Tribeca
here
2019.
We are again. Yes.
And always super happy to be here, always super happy Woo-hoo. To be excited to be part of the film festival. We've talked about it, I think, on many podcasts about coming to Tribeca if you're in the New York area. But wow, what a feast it is. And we're fortunate enough to get the press access, which means that we get to gorge ourselves on movies for the next 3 days. It's going to be kind of intense for us, as it mm-hmm. always is. Always comes at the cost of eating and sleeping. And
although we have been sleeping. More refrained. I was trying to optimize today, and I actually stopped myself from being too greedy.
Yes. Rashmi gets very optimizey when it comes to film festivals. Instead of picking out the movies that she primarily wants to see, she sees how many she can get in one
Correct.
Day. And I think the record was 7, I think, for last year. We're not going to try and do that
That's
this year.
That's too much.
No, I think 5's my limit, then my brain
turns
to porridge.
I agree with you. 5 is a good number. 4 is perfect.
A day, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, yes. I think 4, after 4, my brain starts to turn to mush. I can do 5, but the 5th one tends to be a little bleh. So anyway, so here we are in wonderful Manhattan. It's great to kind of have it's our Movie Wallace annual trip to New York, and so far so good. We've been here for a couple of days. Yazdi, you just got in this morning on the red eye, so I'll forgive you for
and
being a little
a trooper.
Lower
Super
energy.
Trooper, yes.
Look, he's had some sugar here.
It's
delirious fatigue.
I'm delirious so that I may not pass out. Yes.
So we've got a bunch of movies to talk about today. I'll read off the names, and then we'll try and tackle them in some sort of order. But we've got the movies Halston, Charlie Says, Luce. Loose. My brain wants to make that two syllable for some reason. Standing Up, Falling Down. We have At the Heart of Gold, The Gasoline Thieves, After Parkland, and then we have A Regular Woman that you saw.
And Burning Cane.
And Rashmi, you saw one more.
Come to Daddy.
So it's going to be kind of a packed...
lot of movies.
Movies. Not all of us have seen everything, so we'll try and get through them in some sort of reasonable length of time. But let's start, I guess, with the movie that Rashmi and I kicked off the film festival with yesterday, and that is the movie Halston. So...
yes, and... I can introduce that. So Halston was screened as part of their Spotlight documentary series, and it's directed by Frederick Cheng, and it's a USA-based documentary. And per the description at the film festival, from Jackie Kennedy to Studio 54, Halston's minimalist designs put American fashion on the map in the 1970s. Tribeca alum Frederick Cheng examines the work and life of the enigmatic visionary who called himself Halston. So pretty much self-explanatory, it's about the designer. And you both saw it.
Yeah, so I was drawn to this one because it has three of my loves. The place, which is obviously New York. It's about fashion. And I knew about Halston for some reason when I was very, very young. He was very popular in the 70s. And disco. It has a lot of Studio 54, and you guys know that I'm a complete fan of that period in history. So I always think it's very interesting when you watch any documentary about someone who was such a pioneer or considered somewhat of a genius in anything that they do. And this was a really interesting documentary that I think used fashion as a vehicle to talk about what was going on at the time. So historically, I learned a lot about attitudes and place. And then I think sort of like how we moved into the 80s and this time of decadence and, you know, corporate America. So for me, very, very enjoyable. And I definitely came out educated and entertained.
Amazing. Yeah. amazingly, I'm not hugely into fashion. I know, I guess, through imbibition, because Rashmi does know a thing or two about, you know, the fashion and the designers. I didn't really know about Halston and quite the cultural impact that he had. And so, you know, I came at this with, you know, relatively naive perspective in terms of, you know, it really was the first film that we could access, having picked up our press badges, going straight into the screening. So I didn't do any homework, and this wasn't particularly on my list of things to see. But yeah, as kind of a history lesson and a backgrounder of kind of how we got to the world of fashion as it exists today, because Halston was clearly very influential in the world of American fashion. And this documentary was a very competent portrait of that man, and by association also of that time. So it kind of takes us through the world of fashion as it, you know, transitioned from the 60s, 70s and 80s. Particularly, there was some emphasis on the 80s, because I think that's where he really came into being and being the power of fashion as he was. So really interesting also to look at both the business side as well as the artistic and creative side. So again, I think as a portrait of a person, you know, you could see the kind of, you know, tension that exists between fashion as a creative endeavor, which, you know, we have the artist and his idiosyncrasies and characteristics, but also, you know, his battle with commercialism. I think he not only wanted to be, you know, successful and thought of as a creative genius, but also wanted to be incredibly successful financially and influential. So I thought this was a really well put together documentary and just very enlightening about the whole era.
Yeah. And if you're, sorry, just a fun fact, which I didn't know, is he actually started life as a milliner, and he's most famous for designing Jackie Kennedy's very famous pillbox hats.
I was asking, having not seen it, is this more about the fashion industry at that time, or do you get particular insights about the man that were previously unknown, or a little bit of both?
Bit of both.
Yeah, I would say it delivers on both. I mean, I think maybe I overemphasize the fashion side, because I think in some respect, this movie would have had a lot more relevance to you if you were highly interested in the world of fashion. And I don't mean to put that as a knock against the movie's general accessibility. It's very, very accessible. But I also think that if you had, you know, a big interest in fashion, you'd get more out of it, because a lot of it does focus on him, the person, and his the people that worked with him most closely, you know, his personal life and his working life and characteristics. So very much more from my perspective, and I think the name gives that away. It's a portrait of a man. It's a biopic, and it's very, in my opinion, heavily focused on him and how he was and the way he worked and his life.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely, if I had to sort of not a criticism of the movie, but just a point to make, is that it's much more heavy in terms of a documentary than joyful, right? It's
for sure.
Not frivolous. It's a very serious, quite heavy, information-packed documentary.
Heavy is the right word to use there. I mean, I think, you know, it has, throughout its entire running time, this very heavy, serious tone to it, as if they're trying to do justice. I think, you know, they're trying to, you know, it's kind of like, to me, it's, you know, how Walter Isaacson would have bio'd this guy. You know, it really gets beneath the surface and looks at what made him tick, but also does so with, you know, kind of a real sense of importance and heft to kind of how they spoke about him. So a great movie to kick off
really
the film
good.
Fest
yeah.
with. I mean, you know, I always struggle with too many documentaries at film festivals because, you know, there's a lot of narratives can be kind of hit or miss. I think documentaries can be a little bit more predictable in terms of if you're interested in the subject matter, generally you'll get something out of it. But no, this was really good. So
next up
was the movie Charlie Says. So again,
so Charlie Says was again part of the Spotlight narrative series showing at the Tribeca Film Festival, and it's directed by Mary Harron, who most famously helmed American Psycho. Gosh, a long time ago. So the same director here. And Charlie Says essentially tells the story of Charles Manson as seen through the fresh eyes of his most devoted followers, specifically Leslie Van Houten, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Susan Atkins. So I presume this is based on real life individuals, and it's obviously a recreation of the Charles Manson story. So tell us.
So, you know, the Manson murders are infamous within American folklore. I knew going into this, you know, very little about the specifics of the murders, but obviously Charles Manson is a notorious character in history. So, you know, this movie, I think, seeks not to necessarily get into the psychopathy of Charles Manson. I think it's very much shot from the perspective, and I think the source material that the movie is based on is a book by one of the, certainly a large part to some large extent, a book that one of the women who perpetrated one of the murders had written. So it's very interesting. This movie, to me at least, came from a very feminine perspective. I think it shows Manson almost in a more of a charming light. You could see how seductive he was here to the people around him versus, you know, what we think of when we think about Charles Manson, which is this, you know, intensely psychotic individual. And clearly the madness is there. Clearly the dark side is there. But for me, for the most part in this movie, he came across as kind of a charming hippie type that was very able to influence and seduce these young girls around him, in particular men too, but also the young girls. So from that perspective, I think the movie was incredibly effective. I think it was, you know, there's a lot of material around this, and I'll be interested to see what Tarantino does later this year with his take on the Manson murders. But you know, this one I thought was very effective. Rashmi?
Yeah, and I was actually interested to see this one because I wanted to see this one before the Tarantino one comes out, given its, you know, similar subject matter. So this was a really good movie. This has got under my skin. And I think it's got under my skin because we've never really seen a movie that tells you, and I'm going to call them victims, the victim's point of view. Now, they were put in jail because obviously these women did the murders. But in my mind, they were victims themselves of being brainwashed by this very charming, crazy person. So for that reason, the way the material's treated is just superb. Mm. And it was a slow burn. Mm. Nothing happened quickly. We got to understand who these characters were and what each of their journeys were that brought them there in some ways. And I would say all the women in this movie are very brave. They're very brave performances. They're very naked, literally and emotionally at times, that they put them through. I liked that it's not over talky. And a lot of it rests on the fact that the two main lead women, Sosie Bacon and Hannah Murray, do such a good job with their faces. It was just incredible to watch. I really, really like this movie. This is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, definitely very impactful. And I think there's a thing to be said that Manson himself isn't as menacing as a character in this movie. But again, I think, you know, being shot from the perspective as it is, it's deliberate because really we're very focused on how these young women were coerced into perpetrating the things that they did. And, you know, these aren't fool, you know, that you could think of them as foolish young girls. How could they be so easily brainwashed? But, you know, that it doesn't go into great detail about their backgrounds and what led them to a place where, you know, this need to be accepted and loved and belonging, you know, was so appealing about being part of the Manson cult. But nonetheless, you do get a sense for how once they found this thing, that they were drawn into it. And it does a very nice job as well of the lead character is constantly kind of questioning herself. Is she making the right decisions? And something doesn't feel right about it to her. But again, you know, being young and insecure, you can see her battling almost internally with the idea that she knows that something's not right about this situation, but the thought of being rejected from this cult, this group of people, this band of individuals, is more scary to her than going for the ride because of, you know, the abusive love that's part of the situation.
And I don't think it's ever asking you to sympathize with them because, you know, clearly these women committed murder and did terrible things.
I don't know. I think it is.
But I think it's trying to go behind the curtain a little bit. So, again, great movie.
Yep. Okay. Movie number three then is Loose.
So Loose is directed by Julius Onar, and it is screening as part of the feature narrative, as part of a feature narrative at the Tribeca Film Festival. And Loose is played by Kelvin Harrison Jr., who interestingly also appears in another movie at the film festival called Gully, which I think is going to be screening in the next couple of days. And Loose is a picture-perfect all-American teenager until an unsettling essay that he writes sets him on a collision course with an overbearing teacher played by Octavia Spencer and his adoptive parents played by Tim Roth and Naomi Watts. So this is Julius Onar's searing blend of psychological thriller and domestic drama. It seems completely up my alley. This is one I really wanted to watch. I'm team Octavia Spencer. I'm curious to hear from you. Is this one I need to run out and watch?
Absolutely. So this is, I literally wrote, plays more like a psychological thriller with the kid being a perfect sociopath. I'm very excited to see what Kelvin Harrison Jr. does because he did an amazing job of playing many emotions at the drop of a hat. Like they change within one scene to another scene. I think it's a little bit overcooked at the edges. There's a lot of material in here. There's a lot that this filmmaker is trying to talk about and sort of tease up a lot of different subjects, but we don't necessarily get to explore all of them in detail, and that's okay. Because what does play out is very entertaining and very well acted, and it really is a perfect cat and mouse. Often you don't know who the cat and the mouse are, though, because they change and the stakes change. But great acting and great to see Tim Roth back again.
We need to talk about Loose, is what I'll say. And I say that because it evokes in many ways the We Need to Talk About Kevin movie from a few years ago from Tilda Swinton. Well, so here's what I'll say. This movie is crammed full of really clever ideas about, you know, personality, stereotypes, race, and it's all extraordinarily clever and well executed. And I think perhaps a little too clever for its own good because it goes through a number of reversals and flips of expectations. It plays with our expectations. It deliberately does the sleight of hand to lead you to think about the character in one particular light and then shows something else later on that makes you, you know, gives you a different impression of what the character is up to. So it constantly keeps you on your toes. And I think, you know, if I was to criticize the movie in any way, I think it does that flip one too many times in that there are times when I was lost. I'm like, am I supposed to be siding with this character and disliking this character, or is this character the enemy? So it's doing that, you know, intentionally, because all the time it's playing with your expectations and you know, no one is is kind of safe. No one is innocent. No one is. So it does that really well. But I think the standout for me is the performance. I mean, super performance is Naomi Watts, Tim Roth, Octavia Spencer, who I think Spencer is just note perfect. She knocks this one out of the park.
Again.
But also Kevin Harrison Jr. As Luce is, again, note perfect because, as Rashmi said, he plays both sides of the coin at different times in the movie, and it's frightening because his intensity when he's being good is so good. His intensity when he is perhaps misbehaving is equally believable, and so you never quite know how to feel about him, which makes him a very interesting protagonist and constantly frightening for us as the audience. But it's really an excellent movie, yeah. And I think it's one that deserves the film craft here is really superb here. I think, again, if I was to knock it for anything, it was one too many steps ahead of me. I don't mind when a movie is ahead of me, but it was one too many steps ahead of me at one point in the movie, and I was like, well, wait, what and who and how? Luce is...
It does a really exceptional job of holding a mirror up, and I've said this about some other movies. I think I said it about BlacKkKlansman at the end of last year. It does a great job of holding the mirror up to you as the audience, and really poking your own biases.
Yeah, where are your prejudices?
Correct.
And
what are you thinking right now? Would you think like the parents? Would you think like the teacher?
And the other thing the movie does very well is it does it with a surprising number of characters.
Yes.
Because, you know, sometimes you're empathetic for the parents because of the situation that they're handling, but at other times you're less empathetic for them with them because of how they're handling it and the choices that they make. So again, constantly flips, twists, turns you upside down, inside out, back to front, but an extraordinary narrative work here, and
I can't wait to see what this guy does.
Yeah, it's a real triumph. But yeah, Kevin Harrison Jr., super standout here.
I can't wait to see this one. Maybe
I'm
I'll
sure
catch
it's going to get a full release.
Okay,
I hope it does.
Yeah, no, I think it's a kind of movie that I think will do very well commercially.
Okay.
Movie the next move up, the next movie up here is Standing Up, Falling Down.
Okay, so this is where Yazdi gets to join us now.
Yes, my first movie.
Yeah, so Standing Up and Falling Down. Standing Up, Falling Down is directed by Matt Ratner. And basically, Ben Schwartz, who plays the main character, Scott, is a sort of like a stand-up comedian who basically doesn't quite hit it and has left his house on the East Coast and decides that, you know, he's got to go back home again. And he finds an unexpected connection with Billy Crystal, who's a local dermatologist. And so we kind of have like a buddy movie in some ways, but it's about returning home and what happens when, you know, your dreams die, I guess. So Yazdi, this was your first movie with us. What did you think?
So I know exactly what this movie is going for. I know exactly the kind of... it wants to be a blanket. It wants to be a blanket which you cozy up to and you cuddle up to, and it gives you warmth and it makes you smile and and comforts you. And I think at some level it's successful in doing that. It just felt like I would have liked a thicker blanket. It seemed a little shallow at times. I think for me the one big revelation about this is that, you know, I thought that Robin Williams had kind of turned in his coat and hung it and was never going to come back to the movies. Not Robin Williams, sorry,
Billy Crystal.
Billy Crystal. And
it's
and
late. You it's forgive late. Him. You're on a red eye. You're dealing with 2 hours sleep, and they look alike.
And yeah, but Billy Crystal is really gold. I mean, I think he's got it, and he always will, as long as he's in movies. And some of it seems improvised, and you can see that the screen just comes alive when Billy Crystal is on the screen. The lead character is good. I think he's been scripted to be a little bit too disagreeable. But I really liked his relationship with his sister. I liked his sister's relationship with her boyfriend and the family and so forth. So this is the kind of movie that I should just lap up completely and just fall in love with. But I just wish the script were a little bit tighter, and it would have it had plumbed a little more emotionality out of it. It just came across as somewhat plastic.
Joe?
Yeah, I think everything you said there is very true. I think it worked a little better for me than maybe it did for you, because I found the movie overall to be quite charming. You're right. I think the lead character here is deliberately portrayed to be a bit of a jerk. And, and frankly, Ben Schwartz is too warm and charming to sell that to me in this particular role. So I won't say he's miscast. He's not. He's right for the role. But I just, like you said, didn't buy some of the jerk behaviors that we got sold. But nonetheless, I mean, I did find it very charming. It had that very Mike Birbiglia feel to it, with the self-deprecating humor. You know, this is about a loser. He's, you know, a failed stand-up comedian. He has to come back home. And that note of self-deprecation is kind of a constant theme as he's battling with, you know, his many, many failures, his failed relationships, his failing career. His no, you know, lack of vision for where and how he wants to get anywhere in life. But overall, I mean, I think as a comedy, it passed the laugh test for me. I think there were a couple of genuine, very funny moments in it. And I, like you have already said, Yazdi, Billy Crystal steals every scene that he's in. He, you know, maybe when we first see him, it's a little overplayed. But once he kind of settles into that role and becomes, you know, a bit more fleshed out, fully rounded, and believable, then it works. So, you know, for me, a great, very effective little comedy. You know, not the next big thing here, but definitely a wonderful, you know, definitely worth our while.
I really enjoyed this movie, and I think the movie works. I'm going to actually contradict you guys. I think Ben Schwartz holds his own against Billy Crystal, and I actually like the scenes when Billy Crystal wasn't involved, although I thought they had really, really good chemistry. Ben Schwartz, I think, played this note perfect. You know, he wasn't too spiky. He was a little bit disagreeable, but then that only made the journey much sweeter at the end. The only thing for me was it was very predictable. You could see all of the cogs turning to get to the end. And literally, I wrote down three of the plot points. I was like, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And all three things happened. So I would say that kind of knocks it down if we were scoring this one. But nonetheless, I think it was a great journey and it was very funny. I mean, genuinely funny.
Yeah, it has its good moments. There's no question about it.
And it's very polished as a whole movie. Yeah, it's a very polished, well put together movie. I like the parents. I like each of the characters. But I could just see everything coming.
Yeah, and I really wish the movie hadn't gone into such a familiar path at the very end. That was just like, you know, what ultimately
all
transpires.
All three things at the end. I was like, don't.
but I think these kind of movies do these kinds of things.
But and you know, we expect again, them they to, are yeah. they are like hugs. It's definitely worth your time if it gets a release.
Definitely a charming little release.
Yeah, and I like the title.
Yeah. Yeah.
The little play on words.
Yeah.
Standing up, falling down.
Yeah.
Standing up, referring to the stand-up comedian.
Yeah, exactly. Nature.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds good. Okay. Movie number five then today is going to be At the Heart of Gold.
Okay. So this is another documentary at the Tribeca Film Festival. It's directed by Aaron Lee Carr. And it is about the most unpleasant topic of Dr. Larry Nassar, who, as we know, in 2016, the USA Gymnastics was rocked by the revelation that national team Dr. Larry Nassar had been abusing young athletes for decades. And Tribeca alum, Aaron Lee Carr's unflinching documentary unpacks the scandal, its cover-up, the aftermath, while giving voice to the survivors. And I think the New Yorker had... I think it won the Pulitzer Prize. New Yorker wrote it was like a 30-page article about Dr. Larry Nassar, and I was reading it over dinner, and I I had to like break it into 10 different parts. It was so exceptionally unpleasant, the sordid details and just like how somebody could get away with this. So I knew about this and I decided I cannot bear to watch this, but it's still quite remarkable, and I think we need to know about this so that we can avoid this. So Rashmi, you were the only one who saw it?
No, both Joe and I watched this one. So I wrote down before the movie started, I know this movie is going to make me really angry, and it did make me really angry, and it made me very sad, and it broke my heart. And more than anything, this is why it's so important to document, to have good documentary, mm-hmm. because they document, in a sense, in a way that we can digest, things that go on. And that's why I think documentaries are so important to watch. You know, gymnastics is one of our, I'll speak for Joe and I, it's kind of one of our favorite parts of the Olympics to watch, like I think it is for most people. If I knew this was going on, I would actually boycott it. Right? Because in a sense, the more that we all watch it, the more that we kind of feed the machine that then ends up taking advantage of these young girls. So I think it's an exceptionally well put together documentary that really does try to understand how we got to this point without being too manipulative. So it would be very easy for a documentary like this to manipulate
you. To be strident, yeah.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, there is a point about halfway in when I think most of the audience broke down. Like literally, I could just hear sniffles in the audience everywhere. I don't think there was a dry eye in the house because it's very, very impactful. So brilliant, brilliant documentary making. I'm going to call it. I think this is going to be Oscar fodder.
Yeah, I mean, this is extraordinarily powerful material, but it's also an example of a documentary that's really well crafted, because I think it does tell the story from a number of different angles. But in particular, I think the most remarkable thing that I took away from this is the scale of the crime and the fact that this monster was hiding in plain sight. The complete and utter the complete and utter failure of everything. I mean, I had when the story broke, I thought maybe it was a handful of girls and, you know, situations. And, you know, it was at the time where, you know, we started hearing about, you know, well, I think it was pre-Harvey Weinstein, but nonetheless, there was this kind of movement in the air with...
Pre-Me Too, yeah.
A lot of, you know, these kind of abuse scandals being spoken about. What struck me more than anything is the fact that this could happen at this scale in modern times. You know, we've heard about, you know, child abuse in the Catholic Church and other areas. And it feels like as a society we've learned that lesson, but, you know, boy, have we not. How did we completely fail to protect these kids from, you know, years? I mean, in some cases, you know, one woman said, you know, she was 36 years old. She'd known this guy for 30 of those years, and he had been abusing her for a large part of that. So it's extremely well crafted. And I think, again, the movie isn't manipulative. I think what it does do is lay out the series of facts from, you know, testimony. And that makes it all the more impactful, because it's not trying to get you to cry by its use of music or its use of overly dramatic, you know, personal accounts. It affects you deeply because of the honesty with which the victims, and almost matter-of-factness that they gave their testimony in court. I mean, there are a couple of huge moments in the movie where this is just how it played out in court, where the girls, you know, at the decision of a remarkable judge, I think, who handled the case, you know, perfectly, got to express in their own words just exactly what happened here. So this is very, very painful material to watch. But it's also very important that we all take a look. And as you said, Rashmi, we all dissect exactly what happened here, because, you know, the biggest crime of any that was perpetrated here was not necessarily by Larry Nassar. it's the adults around the children, which in some cases involve their parents and the people who are in USA Gymnastics that cared far more about the commercial and financial aspects of the enterprise and winning than the girls themselves.
Yeah, I think what came across to me is, in a sense, that line between pushing someone to their potential and abusing them. Mm. And not just the NASA account, but the whole idea of professional sport or highly competitive sport. So I think it really highlighted this whole thing of, and then it kind of leads you down this whole pathway of, then you can start to understand why this happened. Because if your daily life is being pushed to that limit of pain, these kids, these young girls don't know the difference between something that's helping them get to their potential versus something that's really abuse.
Yeah, it's, and that's the monstrous nature of Larry Nassar. I think, you know, he understood that these girls were trained to ignore pain. They were trained to...
He's a monster. He is the nastiest form of monster ever.
Yeah, it's the dilemma from the movie Whiplash. You know, at what point do you push somebody too much that it borders on abuse? Now, this in this situation, it's very clear. But I haven't seen the documentary. But in terms of what I read, a lot of those girls didn't know in terms of what was expected. There were certain procedures which were supposed to be conducted, and they didn't know whether it was medically necessary. Correct. Or whether it was abuse. And they were too ashamed, or they were, I don't know what, they never brought it up until other girls did. And so to really... be in that situation where somebody's so vulnerable and to abuse that is pretty bad.
It was a key manipulation because, you know, as a doctor, he did actually give them treatment for their pain and injuries. Right. And I think the confusion for them lay in, well, you know, wow, I wasn't expecting that particular aspect of the treatment, which was sexual in nature, for many of them. I mean, in some cases, it's just outright abuse and there's no hiding it. But in many of the cases, the girls were literally told, this specific aspect of my therapy will help you get better. And, you know, when they come away feeling better, by in the sense of their injuries have been taken care of, it becomes very confusing. And in some cases, the evil of this monster was that he would do it within
while the parent was right there. Yeah, the parent was right there standing next to them.
So again, the girls end up with this. We could talk about this subject for hours, but I think the movie itself is compulsory watching for anyone that has got their child in sports. I think professional sports are one thing when you know there's abuse of adults in professional sports constantly. You know, you talk about professional, you know, footballers and baseball players and athletes, they're pushed to extremes. But when it's children, we've got to fix this. Again, gymnastics is one of those particular sports which relies on children being trained from, you know, many, many years prepubescent, and oftentimes the top gymnasts are barely through puberty. So when we're putting those very, very vulnerable children into these type of situations, when they're in an adult world, oftentimes in the company of adults that are not their parents and not their family and don't have their best interests at heart, we have to be careful.
This is must see. It's
heartbreaking. See. And like you, Rashmi, I think this is probably, we've got another couple of documentaries to talk about, but I think it's more than likely that this one will walk away with some sort of award just for the film craft of and storytelling. So heartbreaking and very powerful stuff.
Very good.
The next movie then, so we're kind of at a crossroads, but should we talk about The Gasoline Thieves?
Sure. So The Gasoline Thieves is a feature narrative. It's from Spain and it's directed by Edgar Nieto. And it tells the story of a 14-year-old Mexican farmhand, Lalo, played by Eduardo Banda, who, propelled by a need for cash to impress a crush he has, finds himself dangerously in over his head after entering into the country's underworld of illegal gasoline extraction. I didn't even know there was such a thing as illegal gasoline extraction. But here's this little movie. Sounds like a fascinating concept. Joe, you were the only one who saw this.
I was, yeah. And you know, in part, I was drawn to it because at film festivals, you often get access to these wonderful foreign language movies that, for some reason, you know, generally don't get wide releases in the US. You know, people aren't fond of subtitles, to which I go, you know, big raspberry.
But, yeah.
I think, you know, film festivals present a wonderful opportunity, and they're often very well curated. And I, so anyway, that was my appeal. That was the appeal for this movie. What I'll say is, you know, this is extraordinarily compelling viewing for the majority of its runtime. And I'll say that because I'll speak to a little bit about the ending just as I wrap up. But it has this portrayal of poverty within rural Mexico that I think is just, it's done with such a clever, it's done with just the right touch. So, you know, we have this sense of what it must be like to grow up very poor in a very poor area of Mexico. And it's a coming of age story about a boy who, in essence, starts off with, you know, very good morals, but it just goes to show how poverty can corrupt. And the movie has a lot to say about that. You know, there are a couple of, you know, soapboxy type speeches from key characters in the movie, which talk about the corruption in Mexico and about how there's this sense that the government is corrupt and how the system is corrupt. So how are we as the man on the street ever going to make anything of ourselves if we don't also play the game and play the game within the system? And how a young boy who is working hard to do the right thing and to be the right kind of person is struggling to, you know, the plot point here is that, you know, there is the girl, the interest, and he very quickly cottons on to the fact that in this part of Mexico, you know, if you can be seen to be the one that provides, the one that can, that has the money, you know, there's a chance that this girl may see more in him if he can be that guy. And so, again, it's how poverty can absolutely lead to corruption. The performances are remarkable throughout. The lead character, the character of Lolito, is he's so likable, and you know, in large part, I credit him with why the movie's ultimate transformation becomes even more tragic than it would have otherwise been. Because we learn very quickly that we should care for him. We learn very quickly that. And not that we learn, but we feel for him and his choices and his dilemmas extraordinarily. It does overboil slightly towards the end, and I think that's often the case with these movies that try and amp up the drama. I think, you know, this would have been a case of less is more, but I won't let that detract from the experience. This is really worth watching. It's tragic. It's dark, and it's. It's got some very charming moments, but, you know, again, like any coming of age story, you know, you have the decision points that can make a huge difference in the way that your life goes from that point, you know, versus what it was. So,
yeah, I always think it's difficult for a filmmaker, right? When there's so much drama, there's nowhere else to go but overcook it, right? Because you've kind of taken us to a peak, and then you have to almost overcook it at the end for it to kind of all pay off. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
You can kind of see how it happens.
I mean, honestly, I think there was a couple of different directions that this could have taken. And, you know, one would have been perhaps less, in quotes, dramatic. In this case, he, you know, it went full on kind of Tarantino and in the non-comedic sense. But I mean, I don't want that to put anyone off seeing this movie. It was really great. Okay, we can talk then about, should we talk about After Parkland or Burning Cane?
Let's do Burning Cane.
Okay.
Okay, so this is a worried mother caring for her mange-ridden family dog, her unemployed alcoholic son, and the wife who supports him, and a preacher whose wife's recent death has pushed him towards the bottle, and a few of the characters who make up the beautifully rich world of southeastern Louisiana. So this is a debut feature by Philip Humans. And Yazdi, I think you're the only one that saw this. I really wanted to see this based on the description, but I chose another one. So what did I miss?
So this movie, it's been but 6 hours since I saw it, and it still remains a bit of a cipher for me. I still don't know what this movie was about. I blame part of it to the fact that it was the third or fourth movie I saw with 2 hours of sleep the previous night, because I was really struggling to make sense of this movie. The movie is very much its sensibility, how it's constructed, its kind of frequent lapses into surrealism. It evoked for me the sensibility of the movie, the Beasts of the Southern Wild, which came out.
Oh, I love that movie.
Right? So then you would probably love it. So it has that kind of mixture of the magical, surreal with the real, and, you know, things that people imagine because their current condition is so poor. And I think this particular director, Philip Humans, has the distinction of being the youngest director with a film at the Tribeca Film Festival ever. He's only 17 years of age. So he is definitely trying a lot of different things in terms of the visuals, in terms of the structure of the movie. The movie has a lot of close-ups. The movie is suffused by old-timey folk music.
Okay.
It's set in, I don't know exactly what time period it's set in. It's not very clear, but it's set in the deep, deep south of Louisiana, where they burn sugarcane, and that's where Burning Cane, that's where the title comes from. And also the sound design is overdone. So even if somebody keeps a book on a table, you hear the sound. So the sound is, I think, very intentionally amplified. So it has a very unnatural, unrealistic feel to it, which I had a really hard time grasping. And it kind of goes back and forth between these four primary characters. It just didn't work for me. I usually like this kind of stuff. Holy Motors ish.
Really?
But this is, I don't know. I think at times it felt a little too indulgent to me. Mm-hmm. There's like one little piece where somebody is watching on their television The Jungle Book, and you see like 5 minutes of The Jungle Book on the screen while they are watching The Jungle Book.
Okay, that's too much.
So that's like, why?
Sounds very experimental.
Yeah, why? I mean, what's the point of that other than being, cheeky about it? I don't know. And the movie does flip back and forth in time a lot, in fact, constantly. So I was struggling with the fact that, well, does he have a wife or doesn't he have a wife? Or is he alcoholic or is he not? And then it took me a long time to figure out he had a wife, the wife died, now he's alcoholic.
right.
Maybe I need to see it with a clear head again. And I might love it, but be that as it may, this one, I came out just completely scratching my head.
Is it, to me, you mentioned Beasts of the Southern Wild, but Terrence Malick also can be, this, sort of frustrating director, and he can be very hit or miss. Is that, to me, the description you gave me sounds as frustrating as something like that.
Funny you should mention Terrence Malick, because they mention him, as in the,
oh, is that
the
right?
description as well, okay. Because it's lyrically very much like Terrence Malick. And I was
which
I normally like, and it reminded me of Beasts of the Southern Wild, because the director of that movie, Ben Zeitlin, actually executive produced this.
Okay.
And it's shot in this world in Louisiana which maybe never quite existed, Beasts of the Southern Wild. It's when is it set in time? I don't know. Is it set in the 60s, 70s? There are these beasts.
It doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't matter. So it's kind of in that time frame. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The movie is a giant puzzle for me. I could not decipher it.
And that's the beauty of film festivals. I think, you know, yeah, we get to see these things that, you know, either future talent or, you know, something that you won't see elsewhere. I mean, it's amazing what movies do get made and how few of them, you know, reach the mainstream where all of us can see them. So, okay. Next movie then, should we do Come to Daddy?
Sure.
Rashmi, so I think you're the only one that saw this. It was on my list, but conflicted with the Gasoline Thieves. So I'll read the synopsis briefly. Norval Greenwood, a privileged man-child, arrives at the beautiful and remote coastal cabin of his estranged father, who he hasn't seen in 30 years. He quickly discovers that not only is his dad a disapproving jerk, but he also has a shady past that is rushing to catch up with him. Now hundreds of miles from his cushy comfort zone, Norval must battle with demons, both real and perceived, in order to reconnect with a father that he barely knows. So this was in the Midnight category for Tribeca Film Festival, which for those of you who aren't familiar with the festival is all about horror and you know, the more spooky, creepy, scary side of things. So Rashmi, tell us all about Norval. And I should add that it does have as its main protagonist Elijah Wood, who we all know from Lord Mr. of the Frodo. Rings and other things. So directed by Brad Johnson, I believe. So yeah, what, Rashmi, what did you think of Come to Daddy?
That was one I wanted to see as well.
I think it's Ant Titman was the director, Joe.
I completely misread that from the press notes here. That's absolutely right. My apologies.
Okay, so the film starts with you know, the famous quote by Shakespeare, which says, the sins of our father are, you know, passed on to the children. And then literally in the same frame as the film opens, it has a quote from Beyonce, which is, there is no man like my daddy. So that's like the opening frame of the film.
Okay.
This is balls to the wall, crazy, horridy. Mm. It's both disturbing, extremely funny, crazy, and so good.
Excellent. Okay.
This is just crazy. It's such a fun caper. Mm. It was a really full press screening.
Was it creepy?
There is gross violence.
Okay.
And it is creepy. There are some jumpy moments, but it's not necessarily a horror in the traditional sense. This is really good. I mean, and I have to say, you know, Elijah Wood is a good actor, and I've seen him do, you know, very good diverse movies in his time, other than, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies, which he was great in. He's sublime in this movie. He has to play a wide range again of emotions, and he carries the movie.
Mm.
Really good. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Horridy caper is how I'm going to describe it.
I can't wait to see it.
Brilliance. Sheer brilliance. Very evoking of Tarantino, Coen brothers. Maybe a little bit annoying for Joe, I think. But I don't know. It could go either way. Yes, I think you'll love it.
I would love it, yeah.
And apologies once again to director Ant Timpson. I butchered your name at the beginning. So, no, terrific stuff. Again, sounds like a little gem. And do you think it's something that will cross over to a
wide release? Get a main release. I think it's getting a lot of, I mean, people were hysterically laughing. You know, this got some really big laughs, and it's so crazy, and the dialogue is just, it's a gem. It's a gem. This is probably one of my favorite movies here.
Oh, wow.
In terms of the most fun I've had.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Great. Then let's move across then to A Regular Woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, Yazdi, I think you're
the only one that saw this one.
I will very briefly read the description here at the Tribeca website, which is, A Regular Woman paints the authentic picture of a fun and freedom-loving, brave young woman who fights for her right to live a self-determined life. As a German with Turkish/Kurdish roots, however, her own attitudes and wishes are constantly in conflict with her family's values. I'll stop there. Yazdi, tell us what you thought of the movie A Regular Woman.
So A Regular Woman is terrific. It's, I think the whole entire audience was completely spellbound from the start of the movie through the end of it. It is particularly relevant right now because the world seems to be grossly polarized right now between, you know, conservative values versus more progressive ideals. And the greatest compliment I can give this movie is that it is, to me in my mind, is very reminiscent of the movie that we all watched maybe a year or two ago and we all loved, which is Mustang.
Yes.
Which was a movie about these three girls who are growing up in Turkey in a very conservative Islamic family. And, you know, their parents are kind of pushing them, you know, down their traditional paths. And the girls, you know, at least two of them do not want to do that. This particular movie, like you said, is based on the true story of this Turkish woman who was, you know, subject to an honor killing in Germany. And it really puts... I really identified with it because growing up in India, I have seen, you know, very, very conservative families consider any kind of progressive thought, any kind of progressive thinking as being evil and as being...
Anti-religious,
as being disrespectful, as being something which brings great shame to your family. And this is a situation of a girl who was married off to her own cousin against her will. And then, you know, when the husband got abusive, she came back to her parents and they wouldn't take her in. And so she had to plead and beg before they took her in. And her brothers treated her terribly, you know, saying that it was all her fault for not, not making, you know, her husband happy. And then when she finally got away from her house... and tried to make a life of her own and form her own friends, they thought that her new lifestyle was bringing them shame, and things went from one place to the other, until which led to her honor killing. And it's very interesting because in the first 1 minute of the movie, you are told, the movie is told from the perspective of the woman who's already dead, and she says, "I died at the hands of my own younger brother," and it kind of
foreshadows,
and the whole thing unravels. And I think, you know, it's very, very relevant right now because, you know, in every country where you look at elections, there is this pull between very traditional values and progressive values. And I think this kind of toxic disregard or this kind of toxic allegiance to fundamentalism can be so very soul-crushing. So, and there's nothing about the movie. When you're doing this kind of stuff, you can come off preachy or very... you know, having an agenda, but, you know, the movie's just played out very beautifully. It feels authentic. Everybody acts their heart out. What I really liked about this movie is it's visually very nice to see, but they do this one thing where they use still imagery. So when there are certain scenes which are need to be emphasized, the movie transitions to just stationary photographs.
Wow.
And what is really creative is that these are all actors who are playing out this story, but in those photographs they put the real photographs of the person, you know, to whom this happened. So it always reminds you that everything that you're watching happened to this person. So it's quite an achievement. It might be my favorite film of the day. It's very good. Yeah. And there's a smartness, there's a confidence with which the movie is done. It doesn't play games with the audience. It just tells up front what's going to happen. So there's none of this, you know, what's going to happen to her, you know, will she, what's going to happen to her future? You already know what's happened to her, and then you can kind of pay attention to how things came to be. So
I noted here, sorry to interrupt, the writer director of this, Sherry Horman, has also been credited with writing screenplays for Tiger, Lion, Panther. Not the lion that I was thinking of, but clearly she's been working at this stuff for a long time.
And yeah.
Terrific stuff. I guess then our final movie of the day to talk about is the movie After Parkland, which we literally in the last couple of hours have walked away from. Rashmi, do you want to tell us about Sure. After Parkland?
Yeah, so this is directed by Emily Taguchi and Jake Lefferman, who introduced the movie to us. And this really tells, you know, the horrific events at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on Valentine's Day in 2018. You know, they resonate in our lives among the reports and the emotional aftermath, the gun debates, the and social media chatter.
Be very clear, this is the Parkland shootings.
Correct.
The school shootings in 2018, where I believe 17 children were
Died
killed.
And 17 were injured, yeah, in a matter of like, you know, 6 minutes and 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the documentary basically looks at the survivors and the parents of the fallen students in their everyday lives post the shooting. So I think that's really all I want to say. So, Joe, what did you think of this one?
I mean, clearly the subject matter is a very divisive and sore point. I mean, and I think nobody in the world feels anything but, you know, severe sympathy towards those that lost. But those that lost loved ones and the people that died at the hands of another school shooting. But it does this very clever thing, in my opinion, of completely staying apolitical in terms of its views on the gun debate. I think where you ultimately land with this movie depends on your own political views, but I think it shows the human tragedy in a very clear light, and it follows the families of the victims. We hear nothing, almost nothing, about the shooter at all. Again, I think it spurs up these feelings that I think we all have. I think as it the movie about Larry Nassar, At the Heart of Gold, it talks about our complete and utter failure as a society to do anything about and protect our kids in the USA. And, you know, for me, I think, you know, therein lies the tragedy and the spotlight upon which this movie focuses. So very, very powerful emotional stuff here. I think, you know, the families have done a remarkable thing by letting us into their world in the aftermath of the shooting, and we get to spend some very intimate time with them and understand the real human impact of everything that happened.
Yes, Dee.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a subject matter that everybody has an opinion on. It's timely. I think what you saw as a strength of the documentary, that it stays almost willfully against getting very political. I ultimately saw it as a weakness. I wish the movie would come out one way or the other in terms of where it stands. It's such a horrific tragedy. I think what the two directors have been able to accomplish is, you know, have access to these individuals who were either family members of the victims or the survivors themselves, and have access to them during very critical time frames after this particular shooting happened. So I think there are no talking heads here. They let those characters speak for themselves. And so I think as an examination of grief, as an examination of how you handle something so horrific that it's almost unimaginable with poise and grace. I mean, I think, who knows? It's a documentary. You only see what you see. We don't see 100 other things, but what we do see just made me appreciate how well and with so much grace they handle all of these situations. In particular, there's one particular individual who is the girlfriend of the school kid, Joaquin, who was shot during it. I think she comes across as being somebody so authentic and real. And then... I really enjoyed it. I expected it to be. I'd hope for it to be more hard hitting and more devastating than it turned out to be. But be that as it may, I think it's very effective.
I don't disagree with anything that you guys have said. I guess I'm with you, Yazdi. For me, this particular school group of students have done something very unique with respect to the gun debate. You know, there have been, mm-hmm. we've heard this, you know, unfortunately we hear about these mass shootings again and again and again, and too frequently for my liking. And so I was looking for the documentary that explored why this group of students were able to galvanize mm-hmm. other people their age and the nation behind them. And instead, I feel like I got more of the grief, more of the family's grieving, which I think is equally important. But I didn't walk away galvanized to try and help their movement in any way. This is a terrible, terrible thing that happened, but it didn't feel like a call to action
sure.
that I wish it had been. And I wish that when we had left there, we were so angered, mm-hmm. like we were with the Heart of Gold, mm-hmm. that it pushes people to
can change things.
Yeah, to change the world. Kind yeah. of like when you think of something like Blackfish, right? Blackfish. Right. Supersize Me. These are documentaries that make such a large statement about a current state of affairs that they actually mm-hmm. change the world. And that's what I wanted this documentary to be. And I think it felt very, very, you know, shy of that. Yeah.
But I think, just to provide a little bit of a counterpoint to that, I think oftentimes when movies and documentaries in particular come with too strong a point of view, they close themselves off to people who are on the opposing sure. side of the political spectrum. And I think, you know, for me, it's really important that as a society, especially with the increasing polarization of things like social media, we talk about this a lot. We talked about it over dinner where, you know, right now what seems to be happening with the world is, you know, whatever your particular political beliefs, you get nothing but reinforcements of that in any kind of online interaction. And that's pushing people to more and more extremes. And I feel like this movie, in many ways, opens itself up to both sides of the argument to the point where no matter what your political affiliation is in terms of gun rights and gun lobbying, I think there's something to be said here for understanding the impact that this has on the families and the individuals so that we can sit down and have a discussion. And, you know, if you're NRA, card carrying NRA, pro gun, you could still watch this and understand that we have to do something. We can't continue to do nothing. If it came with too heavy of an anti-gun message, I feel like you shut the movie off right, to those
and
people.
And probably I didn't make my point clear. So I wasn't looking for pro anti-gun. Mm-hmm. I was looking for what this particular yeah. group of students were able to okay. do and how they went about that, that made them a movement that the other kids haven't.
Shootings.
I wasn't necessarily looking for the political angle. I wanted to know about how they organized themselves.
Okay.
Because they managed to get, and there was a very powerful scene when they show the walkouts mm-hmm. of all of the students across the country. At that point, I literally had tears rolling mm-hmm. down my eyes, right? I wanted to know how they were able to do that. Like, what techniques did they do? Who helped them? Because there was a lot of fallout around, oh, you know, these kids are getting a lot of money from, you know, George Soros, blah, blah, blah.
Right, or from and the left.
Or they're correct, being, or they're being, you know, taught trained, how to do this. Right. However that was, I wanted to know the journey
right.
of what happened after the shooting.
Right.
And that's the thing I think was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think it would have been interesting to maybe hear more about, you know, the kids did go to the White House. What was the fallout of that? What did you do? What did you follow up? And I think we tried to get there, but it didn't quite come together for me.
Yeah, I think what's been particularly remarkable about the Parkland shooting is like, unlike the Columbine or unlike Sandy Hook or any number of other shootings, is that it has resulted in galvanizing the whole nation, right? They have, and they continue to galvanize the whole nation, and they're continuing to push So there was something about the Parkland shootings which was different in that after this horrible tragedy happened, instead of crumbling in tragedy, as we would expect, somehow these kids were able to use their anger and direct it towards trying to get some constructive change done. And so what was specific about those kids or about the situation?
Because it
was
something the kids. I think that's what sets them apart.
There was something very unique about their organization. And I think I'm not being mean or anything, where I think they are very wily and they're very clever in terms of knowing exactly who to approach, where to go, you know, where to show up in order to make their case being known. So I think they have been being very clever, very disciplined and very methodical and hardworking in trying to effect some change out of this tragedy.
Yeah.
And we miss seeing part of that machinery. But I think it's a question of scope. I think they had access to what they had.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it
definitely worth a watch, though.
Yeah, it's very powerful material, nonetheless. And again, this was one of the audience screenings. You know, some of the people that were featured in the documentary were there at the end of the.
And they're impressive. At the end of the
movie. They received a standing ovation, and they are absolutely what
they're so articulate.
What they've been through and their ability to, like you say, affect social change. I think, you know, they mentioned that they've been touring around the country, you know, trying to get people to take action on this issue. And yeah, very, very powerful material. Okay, well, that's comes to the end, I think, of our day one. If you're still listening, thank you so much for listening to the movies that we talked about today. I think do check out our website. We'll be posting regularly. Do follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, where again, as we go throughout the next 3 or 4 days, we will do our best to keep you posted on what we see and hear at Tribeca 2019. And again, if you are in the New York area, get yourself down here. Come on.
Yes.
What's the matter with you? Why are you not here with us? Film festivals are always a great thing. And Tribeca in particular, once again, has put on a super, super, super film festival. So it runs here until May the 5th. You've got a week or two to exploit that goodness if you're around. So definitely do. Okay, we'll be back in a day or two's time with more coverage from the festival. I hope you enjoy these podcasts. Please let us know if you do. We love doing them. And we will catch up with you again tomorrow. Until next time. Too many movies, too little time. Good night from me.
And me.
Too many movies. Me as well.
And Yazdi's about to pass out here with the lack of sleep. So 48 hours of being awake, Yazdi. You've done amazingly well.
As you guys did yesterday.
All right. Good night for now.